Hello and welcome to Argue the Toss at GameIndustry.com. I'm Shella.
And I'm Drew, and together we're arguing about the things that really matter in games and films and stuff.
Indeed we are. And it is Season 4, Episode 16.
Indeed it is.
What's our topic, Drew?
We went to see this yesterday. We are talking about the new Mission Impossible film, Mission Impossible Fallout, which came out, I think, last Thursday?
Yeah.
Something like that. Maybe that was when the midnight showings were. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, the internet has kind of been abuzz about this one. Like, they've definitely gotten the marketing right for this one, I think. Everyone's been talking about it.
Yeah, yeah. We went to see it. It was a bit weird, our showing, because we went sort of late afternoon. It was 4:45. And, yeah, so we went to see it basically with pensioners.
Yeah.
I don't know if Tuesday is pensioners' day or something for going to see it. But, yeah, we're going to see it with pensioners. And it was quite funny because they'd be like, oh, every time someone got punched or something. It's like, oh, I thought he'd killed him then. It was really cute. It was really funny. Yeah. So that was nice. So yeah, basically everybody's gone to see this. We can pretty much categorically say all generations of people have gone to see Mission Impossible. And then when we got out of Mission Impossible, the movie, the cinema was absolutely mobbed. We're not sure what that was all about.
We didn't find out quite I suspect Mamma Mia more than anything. But
yeah, it could be.
Maybe they had one of those sing-along things going on.
Oh, good grief. Okay. back to the world I like. The world free from ABBA, which is Mission Impossible Fallout.
Yeah.
So what were your kind of first impressions?
We need to give the usual kind of Argue the Toss film disclaimer here, in that I want to say I liked this film, and I'm going to spend the next half an hour like talking about the bits I didn't like. It's more Mission Impossible. It's another film in the pattern that has now sort of been set by sort of Mission Impossible 3, but especially Ghost Protocol and Rogue Nation. It's very much the third in that kind of trilogy. If you take my meaning. And yeah, that's always fun. It was a long one. It's definitely the kind of biggest and flashiest of the Mission Impossible films. I think maybe Mission Impossible 2 had a claim on being flashier, but that's not really a point in its favor.
No.
It's the biggest one yet, and I think they've been hyping that up in the marketing quite a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's a series that has now become really kind of aware of what it's known for, which is to say, you know, practical physical stunts with kind of the added bonus that it's usually actually Tom Cruise doing. I don't know why that's such a bonus, but it is. You know, I think it leans into that quite a lot. So what you get in Fallout is, like, I think it has some of the best, like, action set pieces in the series. There's some really good fights in there. The, like, final act of it, the kind of showdown is maybe the best in the series. But what it did do was, it kind of, I lost some of the immersion of watching it, because the film can't stop making the stunts even more and more outlandish, and it's constantly, like, panning back to show you that, hey, it's actually Tom Cruise. So, especially in that, like, last act, which I do want to qualify that I really enjoyed, it was difficult to remember that I was watching a spy film as opposed to just watching the newest Mission Impossible stunt. And I think as much as I enjoyed the film, I wasn't a huge fan of the way that it's kind of started to fetishize the stunt work and the Tom Cruise of it all above everything else, because that's not the only thing I come to a Mission Impossible film for.
Yeah.
I'm worried that that series is starting to become more and more hyper-specific and taking focus away from other elements which kind of contributed more to the previous films, which I enjoyed more.
Yeah. Wow, that was a really long first impression.
Sorry. Yeah.
It's like, and that was Argue the Toss.
Yeah.
Cheerio.
Yeah. Sorry, I went right into it. Yeah.
So I was just going to say I enjoyed it, but it wasn't my favourite. The sort of internet feedback seems to be that everybody enjoyed it a lot more than they've ever enjoyed a Mission Impossible ever before, and which I find a bit confusing because I just didn't think it was as tight as Rogue and Ghost, or my memories of Mission Impossible 3, which I went to the cinema to see and absolutely loved and came out sort of breathless, but I haven't seen it since, I don't think. So my memories of that are kind of hazy in terms of how tight and pacey it was. Basically, I enjoyed it, but it's not my favourite.
No.
I thought it had the weakest opening. The opening was clever, but I think we were saying this on the way home. It felt like the opening for an episode of the TV show, as opposed to an opening for, you know, a big budget film that you're preparing for. So so I really like those James Bond style openings they have before the credits, and they're usually just really nifty and get you just like really prepped for the ride, and this one didn't really.
No.
Not in the same way. It didn't. I guess they were trying to set a different tone. It's darker in some ways, but I thought there was a lot more comedy in some ways as well. So it was kind of like balancing this kind of fun, quippy, sort of the Simon Pegg element, with this darker journey that they wanted Ethan Hunt to go on, finding and denying his darker side.
I thought it was generally lighter in tone than the previous Mission Impossible films.
Thought it was.
Yeah,
but
it's
then
definitely
reading stuff. They seem to think it's darker. It's like the darkest one, and I don't think it is.
No,
as far as I remember, the Philip Seymour. Sorry to the Philip.
Sorry.
The Philip Seymour Hoffman one was really dark.
Yeah, again, I haven't seen that film in ages either, so I
couldn't
comment on it.
We're going to have to revisit that. So
yeah,
but I remember because he was like a really good villain. I mean, he's just really he was really good, whatever he was in. But he was really menacing, and
as I recall, he was much more of a serious villain. He wasn't a spy film, Bond film villain. He was just a kind of grouchy evil guy, which worked really well, as I recall, anyway.
Yeah, I do. And that kind of sets up all his sort of internal conflicts for the rest of the series, pretty much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
the whole thing with his wife and all that, all the guilt and everything comes from. It's all about Philip Seymour Hoffman. If only we could have him back.
Yeah.
But so how spoilery are we going to go? Shall we let people know?
I think we're going to have to talk about the
set pieces.
There's not a huge amount of plot to spoil. There is one kind of spoilery reveal, but if you've seen the trailer, you kind of already know it. I don't think we need to talk too specifically about plot, because it is just a Mission Impossible plot. There's not a huge amount to discuss. They don't do anything revolutionary.
It's just the set pieces.
Yes.
I guess at your own discretion, we will be discussing the sort of stunts and set pieces and stuff. So,
and I think probably in discussion of it, specifically one set piece, you're going to find out who who the real kind of ultimate villain is. So if you don't know that already, you might want to
come back after you've seen it.
Yes.
Are we going to give a kind of overview of the plot as it? It's just a standard sort of Mission Impossible. There are like bad people trying to sort of break down the whole world order. They used to be called the Syndicate.
And now they are the Apostles. Yeah.
Yes.
It's never explained why they changed their name, really. It's just, okay.
Well, there's a different leader, isn't it? So.
Yeah.
And I guess it's kind of the sort of apocalypse type. It's the sort of biblical washing of the earth of, you know, to start again. So they're basically plotting the sort of downfall of, I don't know, society and everything.
Yeah,
as we know it, to start again and will rise from the ashes greater and better than before. So there's that. So it's standard that they're going to do it using nuclear weapons. So they're trying to get the only three bits of plutonium on the planet.
The three main chunks. Yeah.
There's no plutonium left apart from these like silver
Yeah.
orbs, which keep getting lost in suitcases. So Ethan and the crew are out to try and thwart the villains by intercepting the plutonium, by sort of intercepting the deal and the broker who's sort of selling this plutonium off. And that is basically it, isn't it? So the main villain's name is John Lark, and then there's a sort of shady character. She's more ambiguous, is a sort of she's like a society lady. She's young though, so I don't know how she made all her money, but she's very young and beautiful, called the White Widow. Who sort of masquerades? She has a front of being, philanthropic and sort of hosting charity raves in Paris and stuff. But she made her money through arms dealing. We know that. So she's like a middle person.
I mean, the film does sort of suggest her origins, like right off the bat. So she's the daughter of Max, the Vanessa Redgrave's character from the original film. So I guess she inherited a spy network. I guess that's passed down through
Those
the
family lineage.
Yes,
It's like,
exactly.
and to you, my daughter, I bequeath my spy network. Like, God, I just got this country pile. They got a spy network. So it's like, it's got good location. So we're in Paris. We're in Kashmir. Where else do they go? They're in
London,
London.
yeah, for a section.
So I think those are the sort of three act kind of locations, aren't they, pretty much? So I guess Paris, I guess, should we just go through the set pieces of each
Yeah, I guess so.
section type
Paris is
thing?
the first kind of main one, isn't it? And it has, like, there's two in Paris. It kind of opens with a halo jump,
Yeah, that's true.
and then there is a quite extended kind of chase scene, which is split into two main parts. And it kind of starts out as almost a kind of Italian Job style heist, where it's a vehicular heist where they kind of have to get hold of a target and get away with it, and it becomes a kind of not park. Yeah, it's kind of a parkour free running bit for a while, and then it's a motorbike chase, and it goes over all the kind of different kinds of chase you can do over like the course of about 15-20 minutes, I think. It's really long.
It is really long.
I have to say that's the one piece in the entire film where by the end of it I was like, okay, can we move on from this now? I've
Yeah,
had
I was
enough of
getting
being.
a bit bored of sort of turning another corner in Paris with another cafe with people running from chairs and things.
It's kind of divided into like two separate plot sessions. One where they're kind of retrieving the package, who is a person, and trying to escape with him. And then the second half is it's kind of the reintroduction of the character of Ilse Faust from Rogue Nation, and it's her kind of in semi sort of a semi antagonistic role with Ethan, trying to sort of stop him from doing what he's doing. And it feels like that whole two part thing could have been combined into the one chase instead of dividing it up into two of almost kind of equal length.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah.
But there is a good sort of skydiving scene as well with Henry Cavill, who's the sort of arrogant, he's the CIA agent, isn't he? So he's like Angela Bassett's guy who she sent in to kind of keep things under control because this lot of just wild cards and can't be trusted. So he's there just raising a right eyebrow, as Henry Cavill is really good at doing. And so they jump out of plane, and yeah, it's a really good scene because I mean Tom Cruise is obviously very adept at skydiving and can act whilst skydiving, which is kind of ridiculous. So yeah, he has this whole sort of like rescues Henry Cavill, and it's really cool and tense. And yeah, there's lots of shots of yep, this is definitely Tom Cruise rescuing someone midair.
I wonder how many takes it took to get all of that right.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Oh God.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe I didn't even think of that.
That was the one stunt where I know that Mission Impossible trades on it being kind of real stunts, but it would surprise me if there was not some, you know, editing and visual effects work there rather than just it being straight Tom Cruise doing whatever we're seeing him on screen. It feels like it would be silly to do that as skydiving just for the sake of it when you could get kind of the exact same effect with like minimal intervention. But I
Yeah.
don't know.
I mean, I don't know. It's speculation. So, yeah. I'm assuming Henry Cavill was thrown out of a plane repeatedly. We didn't get a good enough shot of Tom. Sorry, Henry, you're gonna have to. But
Yeah, but then again, I have read like the interviews about a scene that we'll probably talk about a bit later, where he was just kind of, it's a helicopter chase where he was kind of he was actually in there the whole time. Tom Cruise was, you know, doing his thing, and Henry Cavill, it wasn't a stuntman for Henry Cavill either. He was kind of doing all of
okay,
that.
yeah. I have a feeling it's one of those things that when you sign up to play opposite Tom Cruise on a Mission Impossible film, you're going to be like, I'm doing my own stunts too. I can do this. I can match Tom stunt for stunt. God damn it. It's one of those things you tell yourself and you're just like, yep, I'm ready for it.
Yeah, I imagine that even if you come to that film not wanting to do your own stunts, I imagine that it's very difficult to say no to Tom Cruise because you saw it as well. That video that's been going around on YouTube where he kind of has James Corden skydiving. Because I've always said to myself, oh, I probably wouldn't be able to skydive. I probably wouldn't skydive. But if Tom Cruise asked me to do skydiving, I'd probably skydive. I'd be like, okay, well,
Yeah,
I
he's
can't say
very
no to this.
charismatic and he has a boundless enthusiasm and confidence, doesn't he? Which is
Exactly. You don't want to be
probably
the
quite
person who
infectious.
disappoints Tom Cruise.
Absolutely not. So, what was the worst moment of your life? The disappointment on Tom Cruise's face when I didn't go skydiving. So that was Paris. Then we went to, was it Kashmir next?
No, it's London next.
London. Yeah.
Which there's I mean the London scene is kind of just another on foot chase, as I recall.
Yeah, it was a cool one though. It was kind of had that Bourne feel to it with Simon Pegg kind of shouting instructions. And I love scenes like that where as one of my favorite Bourne scenes is in Waterloo Station where he's telling the journalist to when to duck and yeah, all that sort of
That's really good.
stuff. Yeah, love that scene. And it was kind of a bit like that. And it was funny. It was really funny because, you know, Simon Pegg didn't realize where he was sending him, that he was like scaling rooftops and stuff. And yeah, so it was funny. It was London looked beautiful. That's my city, so that's always nice to see. Did they put a roof on the Millennium Bridge though? There was I was
I
just wondering what
didn't
bridge
notice if
that
they
was
did.
that he ran across towards the Tate Modern. But yeah, it was a cool scene.
It's kind of, it's a
Yeah, it's
rooftop
a
chase.
standard, yeah, like running chase, but it was good fun. It was funny.
It's also the bit where Tom Cruise famously sort of broke his ankle, which, and it.
Oh, I didn't realise. I was thinking, doesn't this guy ever get injured? I hadn't heard
They
that
did leave
story.
the shot in, which I thought was good. It's the one where he kind of jumps from building to building and kind of doesn't quite make it and has to grab it on his own. They don't leave in the shot where he actually breaks his ankle. That was replaced with something different. But when he climbs up on the other side of the building and he's kind of running along and limping, he's doing that on a broken ankle, which
Oh
I thought was,
really?
I thought that was quite cool.
Oh, right, okay. So it's like Viggo Mortensen. in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, well, what happened there?
Where he, they're looking for the hobbits in Rohan, and he kicks the helmets because they come across the place where they've been kidnapped by the Uruk-hai and all that.
Right.
And he kicks the helmet, he breaks his toe in shot. And that sort of like primal scream is him going, ow. But they just kept, yeah, he just like ran with the shot kind of thing.
Yeah.
Oh, haven't you watched the commentary for all of the Lord of the Rings films?
Funnily enough, no.
I have. They're really good, actually.
I'm sure they are, and I always want to watch the director's comments on films like that, but
yeah.
I never do because I always get 5 minutes in and think, I just want to watch the film.
No, I'm so... Yeah, I watched them as soon as I got the DVDs. It was like the thing I looked forward to the most, getting the DVDs. Yeah. But anyway, we've gone off topic so badly now.
Yeah.
And then
it's Kashmir.
Yeah,
which
otherwise known as the Uncharted Act.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it really is.
Which is what I've dubbed it. Yeah, because I was just like, it's because you can imagine if Uncharted was in Kashmir, it would be, you know, snowy peaks, and then you have that panning shot of the new landscape that you're in that's going to be the setting for the next piece of gameplay and the sort of like set pieces that Nate's going to come up against. And it is shot just like that. You get this shot of like, there's the village, there's the medical camp, there are the mountains that Tom Cruise is probably going to fall off or crash into. It just made me smile. And the stunts as well, the set piece in Kashmir was pure Uncharted.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was fantastic. People were laughing like you do at the beginning of an Uncharted game, and Nate's just getting into more and more ridiculous things, like everything he touches falls off a ravine.
Yeah, I think this was another thing that was enhanced by sitting in a room full of pensioners who weren't like kind of... I have a feeling if it was a room full of like teenagers, they would have been taking all that seriously. Just things get more and more ridiculous in that kind of final helicopter chase sequence. It's kind of the most Mission Impossible that you could possibly get. There are two bombs, there are two nuclear bombs, which are both counting down to like with like a physical timer, and there's also another thing that has to be done, and there's a chase between two helicopters, and it's clearly the way that they approached that scene was, okay, how far can we push one of these stunt sequences? How ridiculous can it get? It's a lot of fun, but again, it goes back to that kind of thing I said at the start, where I really loved watching that, but I hope it doesn't become the thing that Mission Impossible is just doing, because at its best, it produces a film like sort of Rogue Nation or like this. At its worst, that is Roger Moore's James Bond, where they just just make a comedy of it, and I like those films. I don't want them to descend into like self-parody.
Yes, exactly. It is just becoming a bit too kind of knowing almost like it's a live show between the people making it and the audience.
Yes.
It's like, look, and we're doing this, and we're going to go there. And you just feel this kind of presence all the time of the makers, as opposed to, like you say, that immersion is kind of broken because, you know, they're kind of just... playing us kind of thing.
Yeah. It's a really fine line between like Ethan doing those oh god what now facial reactions in the way that he does and doing them directly to camera.
Don't go Roger Moore.
Yeah, to be fair, like Fallout definitely stays on the good side of that.
It's
treacherous.
It's obviously a really safe pair of hands with that director, and you know the partnership they've obviously got, but it's as max as they could go without it. Otherwise, it is going to be Mission Impossible in space.
Yes, I reckon I do.
I was like, but that sounds quite good.
Yeah, no, I can visualize a Mission Impossible in space film, which I would accept. They could do it better than they did Moonraker.
Yeah,
yeah.
Though, the set that third act was. was really great. What about the stuff we've basically talked about, the stuff we really liked? What didn't we like in terms of, like, the plot was just like a standard Mission Impossible plot. There wasn't anything amazing going on.
I'd say it's good. It has the requisite kind of twists and turns, and it has a really kind of, in the middle, it had a really good kind of catch the villain sequence, which I thought worked really well and was one of the more fun moments in the film. I don't want to talk about that too much because it does kind of, like the reveal, even if, like, I saw it coming, you didn't, I think, as we talked about it when we came out. And I don't want to talk too much about it because even if you kind of see it coming, it's a cool moment. I don't have too much to say about that other than it's good.
Oh, like the final one. Okay.
I mean the one where they're in the sewers with the
character. Yeah, no, I didn't see that, but yeah, that was good.
Yeah.
That was very neat. And I also liked the Ilsa Ethan storyline in that. I really liked Ilsa being back because in Mission Impossible the women are kind of dispensable. They're cool and then we never see them again. They never get to join the team. Unlike the men who were just like what do they do? So it was really good. And there was this really great scene in Paris where they just have their two figures coming together, and then they just have this dialogue. He's trying to figure out why she's there and what she wants. She can't tell him. He figures it out. And it's basically they want the opposite things, for their own reason. They have their own reasons for doing everything, and they understand them. And it was just so lovely that, they obviously kind of care for each other deeply or love each other or whatever, however you want to put it. But they are on both the same side and different sides at the same time because their missions are different. And I just thought that was really nicely played. It was just a really spare, simple scene and just set up that conflict beautifully. It was cool. I think that was one of my favourite scenes in terms of dialogue and stuff like that. It was a really memorable scene, the whole setup, the visual, everything of it. It's nice. Yeah. But there weren't that many of those.
There's also so we have the reuniting scene with her, and then later in the film, so Fallout also brings back the character of Ethan's wife, who was in, she was like kind of heavily in Mission Impossible 3, and she was kind of backgrounded in Mission Impossible 4, where they kind of gave her some closure by having her at the end. That sort of, okay, they can't be together anymore, but like they occasionally just like walk past each other in an exotic location and just nod at each other, and they know they're both fine. Which was like, it was clearly intended in Ghost Protocol to kind of close the book on that character, just to provide an ending to that thread that had been picked up from Mission Impossible 3. And now she's back in this one, and it works. It's fine to sort of revisit that, but what it does is set up a quite awkward sort of, it's not necessarily a love triangle because she's married to someone else now, and there's no real romantic feeling between, I mean, there is romantic feeling between her and Ethan, but there's also romantic feeling between Ethan and Ilsa, and it seems like someone like that doesn't get mentioned in the film. They shy away from that quite a lot. It's never, they never have those two characters kind of
It's really odd because then they have that kind of schmaltzy ending.
Yes.
And then Ilsa whispers something to his wife, or whatever she is now.
Yeah.
And it's just weird.
Yeah.
It's like these women just sort of holding court over his bed at the end, kind of. It's hospital bed type thing. It was a bit like the end of when I'm taking it back to the Lord of the Rings again, when they're all gathered around Frodo's bed.
Oh yeah.
It's like everybody's like hugging and laughing and stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was kind of weird how they never dealt with that for such a long film.
And you can kind of see why they didn't, because it is like it's a plot element on top of quite a lot of others, which Yeah, I can see why they didn't choose to focus on it, but it's weird that it gets just no mention at all.
It's I don't know. Yeah, I guess they wanted to tie up all the loose ends with the women in Ethan's life.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing they're not coming back next one.
Fair enough. I mean, I would be surprised if I wouldn't be surprised if Ilsa wasn't back, but I think the plan is to have, like, the Mission Impossible team has always chopped and changed quite a lot through every film, and I have a feeling that, like, so there was that, I can't remember who the character was in Mission Impossible 4 who didn't come, the female character who didn't come back for the next
one. Was she Latina or black woman?
She was a woman of color, wasn't she?
I liked her. She was really cool, and
yeah.
She didn't come back.
No, but I don't get the sense that that's just, oh, we just won't have her back. I feel like the Mission Impossible films are just ones which, like, they kind of cast out of convenience more than anything. Mm. If you know what I mean?
Yeah, but the men get to stay.
Yeah, I guess.
It's only the hot chick that gets, like, changed out.
That's not necessary. I don't think that's true. Because, like, the two...
How many of Simon Pegg and... What's his name being in?
All right, Luther, yes, and Simon Pegg, yes. But, like, Jeremy Renner has now been lost. The guy
from... Yeah, but he was in two, wasn't he? Was he in two?
Whereas Jeremy Renner.
Until...
He was in two, yeah.
Yeah. Because
I mean... You're right, but...
Until Ilsa, like, the women were completely dispendable.
Yeah, that.
Considering
that's
fair
it's
a film,
I mean...
that is, like, all guys.
Yeah,
and
okay.
The only woman is, like, changed out every single time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, alright, you have a point.
So okay. It would be good if she gets to come back again.
Yeah, I'm hoping she will.
Like, yeah, me too, because I like...
Because she is part of the IMF now, isn't she? Or is she? It's, like, left...
Yeah. And I like her ambiguity and the fact that she's kind of shades of grey because she's on a different side. And, yeah. And she understands him because she's a spy or an assassin or whatever she is as well. So, yeah, I just like their relationship. It's kind of cool. I'm disappointed that... what's his name? Wasn't back. Hawkeye.
Yes. I did miss him during the film. Jeremy Renner.
That's it. Jeremy Renner. Yeah. I was going to say Brent Renner for some reason. Is that a person?
No, his name is Brent in the films.
That's why.
William Brent, I think.
Because I really liked him. And I like him as an actor. There's something sort of charming and watchable about him.
Mm. He's got a very kind of everyman quality, which is, like, in the Avengers, that's played on quite a lot, is that Hawkeye is just kind of the human guy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, we did read an interview, a really long interview, with Christopher McQuarrie before the show, and I thought it was interesting that they said they had a really loose 33-page script for this film.
Yeah.
And I can kind of feel that. It feels like it just didn't hang together as well as the other ones have.
No. More than any of the others, this was a series of stunts held together by connective tissue.
Exactly. Yeah. So as soon as I read that, I was like, that explains a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So hopefully the next one will be, a bit tighter.
Yeah. So. I mean, it's something that... like, ironically enough, Simon Pegg has always sort of complained about it. He did an interview where he said he always hates it when there's a lot of deleted scenes on, like, DVDs and Blu-rays, because it means they didn't write the film before shooting it.
Mm.
And I guess that comes from working with, like, Edgar Wright a lot, who is, like, famously plans all his films out right from the off, and by the time they're shooting, that's the script.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's... I mean, Mission Impossible is obviously a different beast, and we're not looking for the level of precision that goes into one of those films, but we are looking for some precision, you know? We are looking for them to know what they're doing before they do it.
Yeah, I just feel like there were lots of loose ends. There were just little flappy bits
Yeah,
so, like, going
the,
on
the one
into,
I really did
story.
Notice. Yeah, the White Widow was the one that...
Yeah.
Like, White Widow's character is kind of just dropped halfway through the film. She comes back at the end for just a brief epilogue to say what happened to her. And it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. It's clearly they haven't put a lot of, like, plot thought into that. They've just said, okay, she can do this, and that's the end.
But
for someone who's a major player in the first half of the film, she disappears entirely halfway through.
She does. And the police woman as well was like another thing that just, there was just things considering, we were saying on the way home, considering it's a film that's called Fallout, there was some things in this that had no fallout at all. So, but on the whole, I enjoyed it, but not as much as I've enjoyed previous Mission Impossibles. I keep calling it Fallout now. It's terrible. Which video game title will they use next?
I liked it as well. There, again, like the thing is, I'm always trying to, like, without including Mission Impossible 3, I've been trying to rank it among the other Mission Impossibles, and it comes in like second from last, which I don't. I don't like putting it there because I enjoyed this film. I thought it was a good film. And I think it's a testament to, like, the quality of the series in general that, like, it's Mission Impossible 2 and then all the other ones are good. But yeah, it's maybe, it's the one I feel I'm going to return to least.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
Oh yeah, one thing I did forget to mention, which we
apart have... from Mission Impossible 2.
Sorry, what now?
Apart from Mission Impossible 2, obviously.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. Although, I've been meaning to watch that one again, because it's, well, after 3, because, you know, I haven't watched it in ages, and maybe it's okay.
Yeah, maybe we'll have to do a double bill and see, revisiting Mission Impossible 2. Yeah, because, I have thought, maybe I should watch it again and see if it's as terrible as I remember. But... what were you going to say?
One of the other things that I really did notice throughout this one was it's weirdly heavy on talking Ethan up as, like, the sole protector of civilization, which is weird. So there are multiple characters in the film who are like, hey, you know why I work for this agency? Because of you, Ethan. You inspire me. Or, like, Simon Pegg or Michelle Monaghan's characters, they're like, you know, Ethan, being personally connected to you is a constant barrage of danger, and, like, I've been kidnapped 7 times this week, and there's a bomb implanted in my head that'll go off if you don't do what the terrorist wants, but it's worth it because you're here to save me and also everybody else. And what it reminded me of was, like, the worst parts of the recent series of Doctor Who, where you've kind of got this established character who is being written by a new writer who is a fan of the older work, and after a while it kind of descends into, like, worshipful fan fiction. And it's not nearly as bad here as it is in Doctor Who, where they will occasionally just open an episode with a monologue of someone talking about how amazing the Doctor is. It does get really bad. But there is a sense that Ethan's gone from being the, like, a capable spy, which he is in, like, the first 3 films, to being... he's got Commander Shepard syndrome, where he's just, like, he's humanity's one guy, where he's solely responsible for everything that happens in the universe, and everyone else is just there to help him out.
It does feel like he needs someone who's at least half as competent as he is, because otherwise it's like, why are these people employed? It's just kind of strange.
In the last act of the film, it's kind of, they just need to hang around the nuclear bomb and cut the wire at the right time. I think we've talked about this before. I don't remember if we've ever talked about it on the podcast before. Have we ever done Mission Impossible before on the podcast? I have a feeling we've mentioned it. But yeah, so Luther, who is, like, I still love seeing him in the film. He's still there. He's still dressed in brightly colored shirts and a big straw hat.
He is Sully, isn't he?
Yeah, like, it's increasingly just, you know, clearly the actor Ving Rhames gets to go on holiday to the Mission Impossible universe, which I'm profoundly jealous of him for. Like, just every few weeks he goes, oh, I'm going to take a vacation and be in a Mission Impossible film. And he just turns up dressed that way.
Yeah.
And, like, I love having him in the films. I'm glad he's been in all of them. He's always welcome. But, like, he doesn't get anything to do here because he's in the first Mission Impossible film, he is the hacker character, but that role has now been replaced by Simon Pegg.
Right.
And, like, Ving Rhames is just, he's kind of along for the ride. He doesn't have anything specific that he brings to the team except to sit there and do something that Simon Pegg could be doing if he wasn't busy having his face kicked in.
Yeah. See, I'd rather have Jeremy Renner and Ving Rhames.
Yeah.
And I think we could lose Simon Pegg. No disrespect to Simon Pegg. He's very affable and all those things and fills that role. But, I just think that would be a good team.
Yeah.
Because Jeremy Renner was... Yeah, I really liked him. And he was more capable.
Yeah. I mean, I like Simon Pegg's character. I'm kind of just a fan of Simon Pegg anyway. Someone mentioned on Twitter that role was originally supposed to go to Ricky Gervais, Ricky Gervais, and we all dodged a bullet there.
Wow.
But,
that would have been a completely different tone. Interesting.
No, it absolutely would, and I doubt he would have made it as far in the series as Simon Pegg has now, because I think Simon Pegg is very charming, and I think Ricky Gervais
because Ricky Gervais doesn't, well, he doesn't go for that. No. You know, he might be a very nice man, but his persona is not being a git, basically. Yeah. So,
But I think you're right. I think I could have stood to lose Simon Pegg more than I could have, we lost by losing Jeremy Renner for this one, I thought.
Yeah.
Kind of great counterpoint to the character.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Because he was just as comedic, but he was just a bit more sensible about it. He wasn't an outlandish comedy character. He just always had he had a very low-key one-liner, which was, he was always piercing, but not, you know.
Yeah.
Buffoonish.
And he just felt like, yes, exactly. He just wasn't there for just comic relief, just sort of larking about kind of thing. And getting into scrapes. Mm. Yeah.
But in my perfect world, it's just all of them. It's,
Exactly. And Ilsa.
Yes. I was including Ilsa in all of them.
Okay. Yeah, it's just the interview we read with the director being really proud that he had not four
but five women in
one film.
Just
imagine. He's like, I was so proud of that. Slow hand clap for Christopher McQuarrie for managing to have five women in his film.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah. And on that note, if you haven't seen it, go and see it. It's good fun. Our screen was a little bit small, but it was the pensioner screen, and I liked that.
Yes.
Go and see it with pensioners if you can, because they add another element of gasping that you don't get otherwise.
That's the kind of talk in the cinema that I can absolutely deal with. I'm normally really hypersensitive to it, but if it's
me too. I know, people going, oh God, that was, it was so funny. Oh, I thought you'd killed him then. It was brilliant. Excellent. So that was Mission Impossible Fallout.
It maintains the standard.
Yeah.
Put that on the box. Put that on the Blu-ray cover.
Says Argue the Toss. Yeah.
Maintains the standard of the Mission Impossible series. Excellent.
And on that note, until next time, Drew.
Cheerio.